I think on the Friday evenings, sometimes you can sit outside and listen to it easily enough. Or in the... Is the door to my right usually open as well, where people can sit and listen to the talk? I think it's usually the case. But most people prefer to actually to listen to it at home, on YouTube. Because you know, whenever I go overseas, you hear so many people that come up to you and they say, oh, we see you on YouTube. So anyway, even just this morning, Singapore, just going into the, where you check your passports, the security, this big guy, you know, with the, all this sort of the equipment, he stopped me. I'm a good monk. Where's that for? Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I didn't know you were in Singapore. Why'd you let me know? I'd have gone to your talks. He saw me there. So it's nice to meet a few people, your friends. So he just waved me through the security pretty easily. Don't know if he should have done. But anyway. So the talk for this evening, a couple of people have asked me to please, can you say something about the Buddhist response to Christchurch? But I'm not going to say just the usual response, at least I hope not, because you've heard that so many times, I'd imagine, the last few weeks. Free Tibet, free the guns. Free the people. But what do we mean by that? Which people? So, sometimes that when we look at violence in the world, causes, fighting for things. Sometimes, maybe I've been around too long. What does that lead? Sometimes there has to be such violence and such pain. But every now and again, there's a cause comes along and it gets into the headlines. And how do you feel when these things happen? How do you feel when there is a shooting in Christchurch? Sometimes that we feel prayers, hearts and minds or whatever. Each one of us, when we're faced with a tragedy, a disaster, whatever, we each will relate to it and deal with it in different ways. And where do those ways actually come from? Is there a different way to deal with things? Is there a way which it doesn't have some tears and ceremonies and then a week later we forget? And there is other places in the world where also people die. Why is it that we just focus on one thing and don't forget? It's almost like we feel guilty if we don't do something. So a lot of our times, as a Buddhist monk, as a leader, I suppose, sometimes people expect you to do things. But the old ways, keep on doing the old stuff, where does that actually lead? There must be something different. And one of the things which I was not just taught, but read from the suttas, which made a huge impression on me, is that number one, we never blame a person or an organization or a country or a political thing. Instead, we blame acts, not people, deeds, not religions or races or whatever. It's people, it's the acts which we focus on. We don't might care where it comes from, whether it's from Buddhists or people who are your friends. Because when we actually start to blame a person or a group or a country or whatever, we do find that the conflict never stops. And it's also, there's never any any pathway for any healing or any solution. And just even talking this evening with one of our visitors, not visitors, one of our regulars, sorry, that she was saying that in prisons you never see a murderer, a terrorist, you never see a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist, because sometimes these are just labels, judgments, descriptions, designations, which is one of the things which causes a problem in the first place. You call a person a murderer, that's what you expect out of them, that's what they become. So instead, we try and find a way to see beyond any acts, speech, behavior. It's just too easy in the short term, but causes problems in the long term if we just see superficially a human being, a religion, a country, a race or species or whatever. So one of my jobs, which I found was really, really helpful, is actually to see in a different way and to try and encourage other people to see in a different way and not just to be brought along by what becomes, like, please excuse me, sometimes fashionable grieving. And I mention that especially, you know, when I was on a retreat, personal retreat, over in Bodhinyana Monastery many years ago, and when I came off retreat, just 2 weeks or so in my cave, or a hut I think at the time, I'm not sure, when I came out, even all the people I met, they said, oh, it's so sad, isn't it? I said, what is so sad? This Princess Diana had a car crash. And because I wasn't there at the beginning of the breaking of the news, because monks hear that too, people come and tell us what's happening, if you don't actually see it these days in the newspapers or in the news sites on the internet, they tell you what's happening. But I never saw it from the very beginning. You never actually got built up, you know, like a drama happening. And because of that, I was really surprised why many people were so sad at Princess Diana's death when they didn't even know who she was. They knew her name, but they never met her, been with her, understood what was happening. But we grieved because it was a culturally appropriate thing to do. But I'm sorry, but I'm a rebel sometimes. I like to see things in different ways. And even like the culturally appropriateness of grieving. 9 years I was in northeast Thailand. 9 years as a young monk, and that was an indigenous culture. Sometimes, you know, we give that word indigenous culture to many, many things, but this was a culture which had grown up on the banks of the Mekong River in the northeast of Thailand, and Westerners had never been there. It had no influence, you know, from Europeans. And there was a culture where you never saw anybody cry when they had a disaster. 9 years doing many, many funeral services, cremations, open cremations, even sometimes just literally just with spades, getting the dead body of somebody off the road when they've been hit by a truck, taking it to the monastery, keeping it until the next day, and then getting the funeral pyre and putting the dead body, you know, crushed and squashed on the road, doing all the ceremonies and seeing the family, especially the wife, losing their partner at such a young age, just hit by actually it was one of the big buses on a new road. Seeing that, and seeing that people would take it, you know, on board, as they were. Nothing which they could do about it. They were much closer to life and death, which meant that it never came as such a shock to them. And they never were culturally expected, you know, to react in such a way, which when I saw it, just how does that help? Unless you really feel you need to. The grieving has to be, as it were, tailored to each person, how they feel they need to react in the circumstances. And if a person doesn't grieve or cry, and that doesn't mean that they're cold or they don't care. It's something a lot different. And this is one of the reasons why, when seeing places which thought differently, which felt differently, which practiced and grew up differently, it was like an eye-opener, a mind-opener, and something which you could take even deeper when you did your own little meditations. Why do we always blame people? Blaming. It's his fault, it's her fault, it's the government's fault. We always want something to blame. And when we do blaming and even punishments, I always say we drive the truth underground. People don't want to admit what's going on, to tell the truth, when the consequences are just so painful or unpleasant for us. So I always want to try and find out why people do these things. And once we know that why, not telling people they're evil or they're bad or whatever, that just perpetuates hate. I always say in Buddhism that hatred only ceases by love, but it's actually more than that. That hatred ceases through understanding. What's going on? Why do these things keep happening? And again, one of those things is the judgments. Putting people into boxes. Saying that you have to be like this or like that. This is your race. This is your religion. This is... So one of my roles is to go out there and just to see if you can gently change people's perceptions. And again, going back to that prison simile, you could actually do that. Just to inspire myself probably more than anybody else. Because when you're giving talks, you really have to get some energy coming up. And I get my energy from inspiration a lot of the time. And that was that telephone call I got from a prison officer many years ago. And he said he wanted to speak to me and he wouldn't want to speak to anybody else. And the prison officer told me that he was about to retire but he wanted me to come back through his high security prison to teach. Why? And then I said, well, you know, I can't really sort of go, I'm too busy going all around the world. And he said, I want you to go, only you, Ajahn Brahm. And honestly, I'm lazy. I feel I'm lazy anyway. I always see you can do some more. And other people say, no, you're doing too much. But you can always do some more. Especially when there's things you can do. It seems like a waste to actually to take a rest. Please excuse me, but that's how I feel. So anyway, I said, I just can't. And I said, why? I said, another monk, I told his prison officer. And he said, no, only you. And of course, you say, why? And the reason was, said the prison officer, all the years that he'd been a prison officer in that jail, every person who came to my class never returned to jail again. And once they were released, they never came back. They had lives. And I wanted to find out what I'd done. I never knew that. I never got sort of feedback afterwards. But why did that happen? And I went back to my room afterwards and contemplated, what is it that takes a person who is angry, who's done a terrible crime, who has killed, hurt, really hurt people? Why? And what did I do that meant that once the sentence was finished, they were actually free? And as some of the, when I looked at it afterwards, it was always because there was this bit of kindness there. Basic kindness. A kindness which would see beyond the crime or the hurt which they had done. To see something more than the society and they saw in themselves. They weren't a murderer. They weren't a thief. They weren't a terrorist. They were a person who'd done a terrorist crime. They weren't a Buddhist. They weren't a Muslim. They weren't a Christian or an atheist or whatever. That was just something on the outside. See much deeper. And then when you saw much deeper inside of them, there was a human being, a sentient being. A person who felt pain. A person who wanted to protect their family. A person who wanted to find a rewarding, meaningful way of life. Whatever it was. But you could see something in common with all beings. Once you started to see what was in common with all beings, it was mostly very beautiful. And very respectful, just like in each one of you here or listening on the internet. You know, you may not just see deeply inside of yourself because you're afraid to go any deeper. What you've been told you are is not what you really are. You go deeper inside of yourself, and that is what we try to contact. That part of you which you can respect. Not the sort of the fear which you try to defend at the cost of other people's lives. You can see that part of you which is, you know, beyond any race or religion or age or gender or sexual orientation. Something which is very soft, peaceful, beautiful. Once you can start to see that, that is what grows inside of people. So once we see what can grow inside of people, then all we have about punishing and just executing or flogging or putting people in jail, oh, that doesn't work. I did give a talk about a few months ago, and that was to a legal a group of lawyers who had a little club, I forget what it was called, and apparently the West Australian Attorney General was there. And what I was saying, the Buddhist idea of like crime and punishment, and just how can we not do things a little bit better? Because I quoted a book which gave me a lot of inspiration when I was a student. And it was a book by Samuel Butler called Erewhon, which was nowhere, spelt backwards. It was a mythical society in which when a person got sick, they were sent to jail. It's your fault that you're not exercising or eating healthy food because you get sick and you spread these diseases to others. It's not just you, but you infect other people with your sickness and you're a drag on the economy whenever you get sick. And it was a different way of looking at things. I'm not saying that this is right or better than the system we have where sickness is treated in hospitals. It's not regarded as a crime or anything bad about you, but it's something which is actually treated with kindness and care. But in this mythical society called Erewhon, that anyone who did a crime, who stole, who beat somebody up or whatever, that was considered to be a sickness, an illness, and that was treated with a doctor. The whole point was turning things upside down, reversing the way it is done in our Western world, where crime is punished and sickness is cared for, the other way around, where crime was cared for. And of people who had crime would look as an illness, and the illness was cared for. In our society, crime is punished and sickness is cared for. In this society, the crime was cared for, looked as an illness, and sickness was punished. So, just putting the other way around, why can't both be cared for, which would be much closer to the Buddhist way of doing things? If somebody has a sickness, not to be punished, but to actually to be cared for, treated in such a way that they can heal, see things in a better way, to do things in a better way. Because when you care for people, all the people I've cared for in the jails, they always became my helpers and protectors. Because I told a story in Hong Kong a couple of days ago. There was one of these prisoners, he was exactly the same person who, when I taught the first time in jail in Bunbury, when I taught some meditation, when about 99% literally of the prison population came to see my talk on meditation, and after 5 minutes of teaching, these 99 criminals, or crims they used to call them, in the jail, then he was the guy who stood up, interrupted me to ask a question. He was the one who's big guy, and when he came up to ask a question, I did really feel a little bit of fear. He was a huge guy, and so I said, "Yes, what's your question?" I think I even said, "Yes, sir, what's your question?" And the question he asked was, "Is it true that through meditation you can learn how to fly over walls?" It was that guy. And of course, when I told him that, you know, only very, very skillful meditators over many years can do tricks like that, the next time only 3 people turned up to my meditation class. But he was one of them. And he became inside like almost a friend. You know, he liked me. But this time in this one jail where they had a lot of visitors being assaulted, being raped, male visitors, like me. And so they had to install security. And the security consisted of some sensors on the ceiling, and those sensors on the ceiling looked like, you know, fire alarms, or no, fire detectors. And they gave me a pen, like a biro pen. And they said, "Put this in your pocket, because it's not a real biro pen, it's a security alarm. And if you get assaulted, just point the pen at one of the fire alarms. It's not a fire alarm, you point it, push the top, and the alarm will go off, we'll know where you are, and we'll come and save you." And my first problem was, I didn't have a pocket. I had robes. And I said, "Look, I haven't got a pocket." And they said, "Oh, just hold it in your hand or something." So I held it in my hand. And of course, this guy, he took one look at me and he said, "You have got one of those security pens too. It's supposed to be top secret." But you can't keep secrets from people. And then he looked at me, and I always remember him looking at me seriously. And he says, "Ajahn Brahm, do you really think that you could even get your thumb to the top of that pen before I raped you. And I looked at him. You know, but this time I wasn't scared, because I knew him. I said, no, you're probably much faster than that. He said, yes, I am. He had nothing to lose. I could even jump you before you even got to that pen and thought about it. I'm that fast. But he said, with a smile, and I knew roughly this is what he was going to say, because I trusted him. He said, but if any of these guys behind you tried that, I and a few of my friends will get to them first. You're safe in this place. And I was safe in that place because I respected. I saw something inside of him which he started to see himself. I see something inside of all people which they don't maybe see in themselves. I want other people to see deep inside of some people who are called terrorists are not terrorists, they sometimes do terrorist acts. People who are grieving, but they're more than their grief. People who have lost really close members of their family, but there's more to life than that. Sometimes people say that when a tragedy happens, that there's no happiness left for them in this life. They say that, but a few months later, a year later, things change, life goes on. And sometimes they never forget the tragedies, but the tragedies are the opportunities to learn much deeper about life. So instead of apparently our government, Australia, is trying to give safety grants to improving the safety of your temples and churches and mosques and whatever, is that really going to make life more safe? Building walls, cameras? Is it going to make life more safe to have razor wire around each of our homes, each of our communities, because we're afraid of our neighbours? Our neighbours may be different religions, races, different places, different economic situations. Is that really going to make us safe? Should we just take down those walls and those security cameras? I'm going to get into trouble with our committee about this probably. But can we have something even better? Where we trust people? Trust? Open doors? Open donation boxes? It's radical. But sometimes I am an idealist. That's my role, apparently, to be an idealist. Sometimes it's impractical, but is it? So sometimes when we go out there, who was it? There was all these little old anecdotes I haven't told for years. There was this fellow, he was a Hindu sadhu, Indian Hindu sadhu, and he got lost, or he was walking home late at night in the wrong part of the Bronx. And a couple of, you might probably call them, people probably call them hoodlums, they actually got hold of him and said, give us your wallet, Mac. And he actually did say Mac at the time. And he said, excuse me, but I don't have a wallet. I'm a Hindu holy man. Don't give us that. No BS. And he said, what do you mean? I really am sort of a Hindu holy man. And because that he saw into those two young men who were trying to rob him and beat him up, he saw something much deeper. And he talked to them. And after a while, they sort of said, I'm sorry, sir, we've made a mistake. And they let him go, and he told people why he was late coming home. And he got in the newspapers, apparently, at the time, and they headline, what the article was focusing on, was that these hoodlums, probably for the first time in their life, called somebody sir. Because they respected him. He somehow touched them. That was his safety. Well, the time when I was on Bunbury Beach, just in the afternoon, about to go to the teaching the prison in the evening, And then I was sitting, I wasn't that deep in meditation this time, and I heard a stone come past my ear, whistling past. And so I said, oh, just let it go. And then another one came past. And after the third one came past, I heard somebody shout out, get off our beach, Rajneeshi. They thought I was a follower of another Bhagavan, Sri Rajneesh, now known as Osho. And at that time, those of you who were there in the, over here in the spiritual scene in the, where was it, the 80s? He was planning to come here and he was creating a lot of news. And people didn't know the difference between a Buddhist monk and a follower of Rajneesh. So they thought I was a Rajneeshi. And they threw stones. And after thinking the third or the fourth stone, which was getting closer, I got up. But not to run away. I turned around and walked towards those 14, 15 year olds. Walked towards them. And you know what they did? They ran away. There's only one monk, and there's about seven or eight of those. But one of them stayed. And I just walked up to him, and all the other ones came back. I said, look, I'm not a Rajneeshi. Even if I was, it's not right to throw stones at people. You know, I'm a Buddhist monk. I said it with kindness. We had a really nice conversation for about 20, 30 minutes, you know, about spirituality and non-violence and being kind to people and stuff. So it was a really good opportunity, which, you know, you can. You don't blame the kids and go and report them to the police, because I don't think that would have worked. You want to go sometimes deeper. Sometimes it's all you can do, fine. But how long are we going to report them to the police and then they go to jail or they get upset and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse? I want to find other ways of dealing with things if we possibly can in this world. So you look upon them in your mind in other ways so that even on the news, on the talkbacks or whatever. Oh, I know that people get a lot of airplay if they say what people want to hear. Yeah, they hurt us, give as good as we can, got. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. All that sort of rubbish which has been going on in our world for way too long. Isn't it more interesting to actually to go out and, as the Buddha said, to love your enemies, and I really mean that. To understand why they do things, why people join crazy hate groups, and actually just not to go looking for them and put them in jail, but go looking for them and invite them to a nice meditation retreat or something, I don't know. But sometimes thinking outside the box, doing things differently. Because I don't know, one day somebody might try and arrest me and say, you know, you're convert from being a Buddhist to somebody else. And just to make this talk a little bit lighter every now and again, because there was a problem in Malaysia and Singapore some years ago, and I remember just talking with the we used to call him the chief. You know, he was the head monk of in Kuala Lumpur, Venerable K. Sri Dhammananda, a really, really good friend, and he was the one who, when he got diagnosed with terminal cancer, laughed. He was just so beyond sort of fear of death that he laughed when he was told that he was going to die. There's something about that which is unusual, and I think that's, you know, something really wonderful. Could you do that? When the biopsy comes, or the x-ray comes, and they tell you there's nothing more we can do, you're going to die soon, and you burst out laughing. That shows somebody has got a different perspective of life and death. Not that death is the most terrible thing in this world, and that we try and avoid death at all costs, and we're afraid of death, we're terrified of death, and when death comes to a whole community, either in a gun massacre, or in a tsunami, or in a storm like happened in Mozambique, and more people have died in that storm in Mozambique and in Christchurch. But there's something different about it. What? So anyway, that when we learn there's different ways of dealing with things. Who knows? Just where we go, looking at different ways of dealing with tragedies in life, learning from them, growing from them, and finding some way they never occur again. Or lessen the occurrence of the problems. And sometimes that just has to be like a personal connections. You know, just making those connections, understanding one another, not driving people into separate little ghettos and tribes in our world. That's one of the reasons why I do have great hope in our world. Sometimes people get very negative when this happens, and we think of all the terrible things which might happen to us, and the world is falling apart, and we need to resort to extreme means, even violence, to actually to keep just the world safe again. Is that really ever worked? So that type of fear-based doctrine, I don't think will ever work. Instead, what gives me hope is that people do travel around, we do meet one another. There are inspiring examples, not enough, but they need to be given a stronger voice. People who can forgive, people who can just reconcile, people who aren't going to go for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, people which can even look at their partner who's cheated on them and just to say, I forgive you. To go to a parent or a child who is really giving you hell and to say, I forgive you. To actually to go a little bit deeper and to see, maybe if I was in that situation, I may have done the same. That maybe I don't understand why you did that, but, you know, I'm going to let that one go. Maybe to be able just to go and do things and have attitude which no one has done before in your family. And reconcile. There's more important things. The fact that, you know, we're friends. We give. And forgive. And give people more space. We care rather than trying to cure. And this is part of, you know, the philosophy, the teachings, by caring for people instead of curing them. Not changing things, but loving people. That was where the cure comes from. You forgive somebody, and what happens? It's so rare to be forgiven. So rare to be understood. So precious to be given another chance. If it comes from the heart, it really is sincere. Sometimes it becomes irresistible. Irresistible. But one of those other great tragedies that I was in, this was actually in Singapore, in one of those talks I gave in the old Taipei Center in Lavender Road in Singapore. And when I gave the talk there, it was just after 9/11. And someone asked me, said, Ajahn Brahm, what would you have done if you were President of the United States after 9/11? And I would have said straight away that I would have got on TV and said, I don't know who was responsible at that time, you know, for those attacks. If it really was a Muslim terrorist organization, I forgive you. Enough people have died already. I forgive. And just to do something different, something which was going to be a circuit breaker, something which maybe people, they tried to push people's buttons big time on a global scale. He said, no, we forgive. This was a religious, spiritual challenge. and it wasn't lived up to. It didn't go that further distance. I remember at the time that at that talk I got a standing ovation and people said, can we nominate you for president? But of course, it was only a suggestion which did not get any traction yet. But who knows? I don't know, did you remember that song by John Lennon, Imagine? I grew up with that, and I was supposed to be a spiritual leader, and so I keep remembering that song. You know, just no hatred, no barriers. Yeah, you can go to the churches or the mosques, but go to the Buddhist temples too. Even recently that somebody said they were going to marry a different religion. It was in Hong Kong. I said, is that okay? Can a Buddhist marry a Christian? Yeah, sure. What's wrong with that? But I said, make sure you go to the temple every, say, Saturday together, and you go to the church together on Sundays. Why not? Break the mold. Break the traditions which separate people, and break what should really be the spiritual traditions, where we come together, where we can unite, where we can sort of be stronger as a family rather than as individuals, where we can just wear headscarves or bald heads, whatever, no matter who we are. So that's some of the feelings which, you know, you get as getting a monk who gets a bit tired from travelling around and dealing with these problems too much. Isn't there something we can actually do? Go a little bit further. It's not just going to work and looking after ourselves and paying off our bills and our mortgages and going to the doctors and making sure that we're healthy and just paying the rent and, I don't know, and getting enough money to go and have a holiday somewhere. Can you really enjoy holidays when there's all this stuff going on? You can if you block it out. But that's not what we do when we meditate. When we're spiritual, we open up our hearts. We really open up our hearts. And sometimes it hurts to open up your heart. You can live your life putting your heart in a concrete box. But that's not much of a life. Take it out of that box. You do get hurt. You do get challenged. You do feel pain and disappointment. You're feeling this world, this life, law of suffering. This life is not supposed to be perfect. Tragedies will happen, disappointments will happen. Welcome to life. But there's some stuff we can do to make it better. Little things. The kindness, the care. Finish off with just that time I did go on pilgrimage to India and had no real control over where the tour was going. So one day they wanted to go on a boat trip up the Ganges in Benares, Varanasi. And I tried to get out of it. I must admit, I said, I'm going to meditate instead. You know, like, it's a Buddhist holy site, fine, but just, you know, going on a tour of the Ganges River. But, you know, I had to because all the people had to go together. So I went on the tour of the Ganges River, and then from the boat ramp to the next thing we're going to do, we had to walk for about a kilometre, and that was where this really poor people, they were a leper colony. And they saw us, Westerners, that's just Chinese, Indians, Sri Lankans or whatever. And they looked at us and they thought we were wealthy. I looked wealthy, fat anyway, good robes. But you don't have any money. So when they asked for money, it was hard. I said, no, I'm a monk, I don't have money. But they said, money, money, rupee. And I was realizing that you weren't getting anywhere that way. They were really poor. If I had money, of course you'd have given it to them some. I didn't have anything. So it was hurting me, seeing this really poor person. You know, it wasn't one of these beggars who were beggars as a profession. It was a real sort of leper with the dirty bandages on, oozing red stuff and yellow stuff and stuff. And I couldn't do anything. So what did I do? I just thought, put my arm around him. Give him like a hug. Not much, but it was all I could think of at the time. But then what I saw next was just really moved me. Saw this wonderful smile come on his face. A smile which he'd still be hungry and needed medication afterwards. But in that moment, he smiled. And it was a real smile, authentic one. And that just warmed my heart. I could smile back. Couldn't give him anything material. I could give him just metta, and he gave me probably more metta than I gave him. And that was something which I saw you can do. It put some of these things into perspective. Yeah, you can go and get some donations afterwards and just twist some of your disciples' arms to put some money in the box. But just at the time, that was something special. A beautiful smile on a person who was sick and hungry and homeless, probably cold. You could do that. And that was something which transcended our differences. A little smile, a bit of peace. It can just go way beyond dogmas and religions and fears and walls. It is an expression of something much more powerful. Not what divides us, but what unites us. Sometimes you might think that the oceans are what divides us. I would say the ocean is what connects us. It's what's between us and brings us together. And the air which we breathe is not an air for Buddhists and an air for Christians and an air for atheists and an air for labor or liberal or green or shooters and fishers or whatever else the parties are. It's the air for each one of us to breathe. It's what joins us, what we share. Those are the sorts of perceptions, I think, which takes away any boundaries, any fears. So those are a couple of reflections. I don't know, just sometimes when I'm tired because I've been traveling, just came back this afternoon, sometimes the talks are great because they're totally unplanned, unforced, got no energy to force them. But sometimes they hit the spot. If they didn't hit the spot, I apologize. If they did, wonderful. So thank you for listening. Very good. So any questions or comments? Okay, come ready. Have we got any ones on the internet? Okay, got some there. But I must admit, Eddie, that you're getting almost as famous as I am on the internet. Because so, there was another gentleman, you know, who was actually, somebody called them up and they answered and they said, oh, that's Eddie Koo. So it's not Eddie Koo, they said it was one of the other Malaysian Chinese who's been here a long while. But you sounded like him. Anyway, Eddie?
Yeah, Ajahn Brahm. Sorry, Ajahn Brahm, I've been talking a lot lately, okay, yeah. But I think I'd like to say something, you know, on this topic,
yeah.
You know,
okay.
On peace and violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Ajahn, the Buddhist way, yeah. The Buddha was telling us, Ajahn Brahm, that our mind is the forerunner of all states, alright?
Yeah.
Yeah. He also said, you know, a peaceful person, you know, a person whose mind is peaceful, his speech will also be peaceful, and his actions will also be peaceful, you know. Right? Yeah. So I was thinking in terms of the world scene, you know, the world scene, okay? Yeah. I noticed, you know, I don't know whether you noticed, you know, like some politicians, you know, okay? Especially from some certain countries, you know, okay? Yeah. Obviously, they are not peaceful. The speech they give out, you know, they are so arrogant, self-cherishing, not caring for others, you know, okay? And also the actions, too, the actions of war, not peace, you know, Right, yeah. This has in fact effect on people's minds too, you know. Because they are giving bad examples, yeah. I was thinking maybe we should have a, is there a World Peace Day?
There is.
Make it a holiday, you know, whereby we can, the people can have a chance to reflect, you know, in the world, you know, on peace, you know, on mindfulness, on their minds, you know, and related peacefulness to people.
Yeah. There is a World Peace Day, but people are too busy to be able to take a whole day for peace, and it begs the question of the other 364 days of the year. But our politicians, we are the ones who elect us, so we are the ones who elect our politicians, so please don't blame the politicians. It's the people who are responsible, the ones who elect them.
Yeah.
So we just, what can they do for us? Money, vested interests, hip pocket, lessening taxes, pandering to our fears. So we don't need to look further than ourselves.
Maybe elect peaceful, what I mean is politicians.
Yeah, but anyway, we need to try and do that first of all. But anyway, these are honest questions. The more I listen to my feelings and the body, the more I uncover strong feelings of rage and hatred I wasn't aware of before. Is listening to these feelings the way to let them go? Listening to those feelings of hatred and rage, but listening at a distance. In other words, once you get entangled in them, you lose all perspective, and it's so easy for you to reinforce those feelings of anger or rage. An example which comes to mind was a religious video which I saw as a young man called The Life of Brian. The documentary. And there's a lot of real truth in there where the PLLP or something, it was one of the groups to overcome the Roman occupation of Palestine. And they had their meeting and started with, what have the Romans ever done for us? And somebody said, oh, actually, they built roads. And it made like transport much easier. You know, you'd try to have a car and it would always just break its wheels. So the Romans, they gave roads. So, well, you know, okay, yeah. But what else have they done for us? No running water, the aqueducts. Oh, yeah. What else have they done for us other than roads and aqueducts? Oh, you know, we've got law and order. You know, sometimes on a Saturday night in some places of Jerusalem we could not go without getting sort of robbed and beaten up, but now the Romans are there. Well, you know, now we've got law and order. Yeah, what else have they done for us other than law and order, roads, aqueducts? Oh, sanitation. It used to stink in some of these parts. They've got sanitation now. They went on like this for a while. What have the Romans ever done for us except sanitation, roads, law and order, and nothing. Nothing. Yeah, nothing. Out with the Romans. It's called fault finding. And not really looking at all the other parts of the person. So that's one of the reasons why, if there is rage inside, there is hatred, but there's more in there. So instead of focusing on the rage and hatred in you, that's called watering the weeds. Look at something else in you, the beautiful, good stuff in you. The stuff which you can respect. That is what I did with the prisoners. Looked in them and they could see it themselves. Their rage and hatred, the bad part of them, got transcended by looking at the good part of them, watering the flowers. So listen to those feelings, the way to let them go, acknowledging them, but look for the other feelings inside you as well. That's not the whole of you. USA, should I pay attention to the world news? It excites and upsets me about things far away from me. Is compassion listening to everybody? Is listening to your heart? And just, you know, seeing some of the stuff which goes on in the world, but not getting involved in it. In the sense of, well, I'm not involved, but entangled in it. And so that's one of the reasons why, and people do try to have the good news stories, but do people want to listen to it? Why is it that people like drama? You know that my books sometimes is one of those books, the Open the Door of Your Heart book. They found the American actress, Jessica something Parker, or Parker Jessica. She was apparently in the TV series Sex and the City. Sarah Jessica Parker, yeah. So she was one of the big actors in Sex and the City, and she was actually seen and photographed reading my book in a coffee shop, Open the Door of Your Heart. So I got really excited. Yeah, Sarah Jessica Parker reads my books. So I thought, well, what can happen next? I'll probably get a letter or an invitation to do what they call like a cameo on her show, Sex and the City. But then I thought, I don't see it, but by the name, Sex and the City, it's probably a bit sort of too raunchy for a Buddhist monk. So they'd have to tone it down a bit. But then if they toned it down a bit, how would it actually look? And I'd even actually, for the episode, you could actually call it No Sex in the Monastery. But then, what would happen? Who would look at it? No one. Without the sex and the violence and the drama, would you look at it? So that's one of the reasons you can see the problem why we look at the world near us. There's something in a human being which likes drama and violence and sex and just even exploitation sometimes. Why is that? So that's the thing for us to look at. Why is it that we move away from peace and happiness and joy and good stuff to this sort of exciting stuff? It's because there is a certain pleasure in fear, in negativity, in just even in anger. Do you remember ever getting angry at a person you felt that, yeah, they needed to hear that? And you feel so really, really, energized. And even actually the Buddha pointed that out in many suttas. That's the reason why. Because there's a certain joy in it. But what we don't see is the dangers in it. Instant joy, we're getting angry. Ugh! While going for a march and getting violent. Ugh! We feel alive, but the dangers just outweigh any sort of pleasure. You got a question over there?
So someone does something that's not right, you can still forgive them and still love them, but there is something that they need to understand, as well as there is a consequence for my actions. Or for example, like disciplining your children, if you're going to love a child, you also want to teach them that some things they do require some discipline, or it's not that you're going to stop loving them. For a mother, they'll unconditionally love their child until they pass away, and a father or whoever's looking after that child. But there is still justice and a system there, and it's not just forgiving them and not doing anything about it. So I'm just wondering, I'm trying to understand what the Buddhist view is on that, or what your idea or take on is on justice.
Again, to Buddhist idea or innovative ideas? Yeah, exactly. So it is fortunately that, she's probably listening, one of our ex-caretakers, Dania, was just sending me a little article about how Inuits raise children. And they never shout at a child. Because if they shout at the child, they say that the child learns how to shout at others. As if it's the emotional appropriate response at such a young age when their emotional neural framework is being formed. They learn another way. And stories, which is like playful, instead of having fear and pain is a way for people to learn consequences. And sometimes the way we do things, do they really need to feel the consequences in that way? Or is there other ways for people not even to feel that it's appropriate? It doesn't feel good to actually to shout at a person or be violent at them. Maybe we can grow in that area. Because otherwise, if it's just people need to be disciplined, then okay, governments need to be disciplined. Terrorists need to be disciplined. Our people we don't like need to be disciplined. Who else needs to be disciplined? The pests need to be exterminated, or whatever. So a lot of times that solving problems, you know, through a violence, it can be feel good for you, short-term effective. Even, should we discipline motorists by fining them if they speed? What happens is people just know where the speed cameras are, and they've got little things on their tom-toms or whatever they call them, which tells them where the speed cameras are. They just find ways of avoiding the punishment. They get expensive lawyers. They do stuff which just, that's not the point. I'm not getting out of discipline. It's so why are you doing these things to others? So sometimes I think there's more things we can do. It's just bunging more terrorists, gunmen in jails. Is that really going to help? Maybe we may just make more. Is there some other things we can do? Banning guns, great. But in UK, in London, there's a huge number of knife crimes. What are we going to do? So, sometimes, looking at it in a deeper way. So one thing we have hope is that at least we go and meet each other. We just marry people from different religions and races. Just, we meet together, do stuff together, play football together, whatever. And when we're not afraid of one another, then we break down those barriers. Please, you know, you're much younger than I am. You just go out there and just don't just go and make friends with people of the same type as you. Spread further. Get to have a wide circle of friends from so many different parts of the world and understand, make contacts. Because if you are colorblind, by mean colorblind, you don't worry about a person's skin. You don't sort of worry about a person's religion. You don't worry about a person's age, sexual orientation. But your friends. Make kindness, not shouting. If you do vote for a politician in an election, don't just vote for someone who promises the world and just sends them in power, just never produces. Or stand yourself. I don't know. I'm just throwing out ideas. Maybe one or two might land somewhere. Anyway, there's another question here. Someone is pressuring a friend so much it's making them ill. When do we step in to help, and how do we do this without further angering the perpetrator? So obviously the person who is being pressurized, that sometimes that they have to protect themselves just by learning not to worry about things, to let things go. Your health, your life is more important than anything else. So if a person just is pressuring you to do this and do that or get this or get that for them, just don't say no, because they'll argue with you. Just, you know, similar to what I always say, I'll think about it. And then you do nothing. So just procrastinate. And the other person, if there's something you can do to actually to remind them that pressurizing other people, you can feel that's an awful thing for them to do. The old story of somebody shouts at you, rah, 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 and as soon as they're finished, you go rah, 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 back. Give them 1 minute of silence, even longer is better. They shout at you, and then you stop, silent. So they have 1 minute where they can reflect on how they've acted. 1 minute at least, they can see that how they've talked to you is totally inappropriate. Because what happens if you just shout back? No one has a chance to reflect on their actions, on their speech, on their behavior. Pause. Moments of silence in tragedies, or minutes or 2 minutes of silence, are wonderful. Because in the silence, we think. Thinking stops, hopefully, and we reflect. We feel. We know what it feels like. We can feel other people's hurt. So if you can do that, give the perpetrator pause. I mean, this is endemic, a deeper sort of malaise of our modern world is negativity and entitlement, and think that someone has to pay for what we have endured. What was it that somebody sued their college or something because of their school, because they didn't get the top marks or didn't get the grades to go to university, and they said it was their teacher's fault. They didn't actually to make them work harder or set them more work to be done in class. Blaming other people instead of taking some personal responsibility. Whose fault is it? So sometimes I always say, it's not his fault, it's not her fault, it's always our fault. Why do we have terrorist attacks? Is it our fault? Very easy to blame others. But do we take some responsibility for the people we elect into power, for the radio programs or the TV shows that we listen to, up their ratings so they get more louder voices? How much are we responsible? So sometimes that's why it's easy to blame others. It feels good to blame others. But can we do something? Be more peaceful, more kind? Anyway, that's just Ajahn Brahm rabbiting on. As I said, in Hong Kong, I think I mentioned this about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there is an organization, it's a therapy group, which is especially designed for people who talk too much, like me. And what's it called? On and On and On Anonymous. So I think I better join that before it gets too late. Thank you very much for listening. Okay, so I'm now going to invite anybody who wishes to with me to pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I just remembered another little promise. That, in the end of June, I think June the 29th, 30th, 31st, there is a conference on meditation, mindfulness. It's the series of global conferences on Buddhism. Global conferences on Buddhism, the 11th one. So I'll be going over there, and some of the really famous meditation teachers and stuff will be going over there. So if you happen to be in San Francisco, if not, who knows? You never know. But that's the one person who is helping organizing it, that they heard me say here that there was going to be a global conference somewhere. I think it was in Perth, and they came all the way over here. And they liked it so much, it changed their life. So there's a global conference on meditation, Buddhism, mindfulness, and beyond mindfulness in Berkeley, California, Zella Beck Hall, on the 29th, 30th, and 31st, I think, of June. Okay, 29th, 30th, or somewhere around there anyway. The last weekend of June, Saturday and Sunday. You know, never know, we can always add another one. We break traditions, extend things. Okay, all the best.